Welcome, everybody. I hope you're having a good day wherever you are. It's the end of the first week of December 2014 already. My name is Henrik. I'm from the land of the Goths, the territory of Beowulf and his Geats, the heart of Scandinavia in what today is the Kingdom of Sweden. If you are new to the program, our website is redicecreations.com and rediceradio.net. We have been exploring and investigating a lot of topics that we've been interested in over the 8 years that we've been doing this radio program, and we've learned a lot along the way about the agenda of the elite, the globalists, the bankers, and what processes they use to manipulate, control, and subjugate us to their rule. We've also learned a lot about the various religions and New Age faiths that they use to decapacitate us, to make us docile and meek, and offer up no real organized resistance. You know, while they're preaching peace and love to us, they wage ruthless conquest and psychological warfare against us. We're dealing with an enemy that have managed to convince you that there isn't a war, or that you should accept their conquest of you, your people, and your lands because it's a morally right thing to do. It's a tremendous, devious strategy. And if we don't wake up to what's going on, and that war actually is being waged against us, well, then we are not going to preserve. We're not going to make it. We have to not only respond to this threat, we also have to take control and organize to stop what they have planned. Today our guest is Kerry Bolton. He has certifications and doctorates in theology, social work studies, psychology, and an honorary degree. He's a fellow of the Academy of Social and Political Research in Athens, and of the Institute of Higher Studies in Geopolitics and Auxiliary Science in Lisbon. He's been a contributing writer for Foreign Policy Journal and a regular contributor to New Dawn magazine out of Australia. He has been widely published by the scholarly and broader media on a variety of subjects, including International Journal of Social Economics, International Journal of Russian Studies, Irish Journal of Gothic and Horror Studies, the Occidental Quarterly, North American New Right, Radix, and many more. His recent books include Revolution from Above, Artist of the Right, Stalin, The Enduring Legacy, The Banking Swindle, Babel Inc., Multiculturalism, Globalization, and the New World Order, and also an introduction to Oscar Wilde's Soul of Man under Socialism. He also has an upcoming book on Francis Parker Yockey. But we are going to begin to talk about his book, The Psychotic Left, From Jacobin France to the Occupy Movement. Welcome, Mr. Bolton. Thank you for coming on the program. Great to have you here. Hope you're doing well today.
Yes, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Well, your book, The Psychotic Left, From Jacobin France to the Occupy Movement, offers a much-needed perspective to, counter the propaganda and the lies that we've been hearing for years now, really, about how conservatism is a mental disease and how traditionalism and things like a strong family core is the essence of fascism and other such wonderful psychobabble. But many studies have been done by the ideologues on the left as a way to kind of steamroll their political agenda into the West without really being opposed to it in any capacity, and it's really worked as well. And I have a lot of questions for you regarding this book and your other writings as well, Kerry, but tell us first, why did you want to write this book?
Well, really, so quite close to what you actually said, there's been a great deal written and commented upon over decades on the supposed psychosis of the right and conservatism, and you pointed out a major factor that high regard for the family or fondness for one's parents is recorded on an F scale of F for fascism by a whole school of psychology that stated that the family represents latent fascism. And during the 1960s, a coterie of these socialistic psychologists and sociologists wrote a book called The Authoritarian Personality, and a team headed up by Theodore Adorno. All these people came basically from the immigrants from Germany and from the Frankfurt School, and they started studying people's perceptions of what we really, previously have considered the normative values of society, such as family. in parenthood. And people who had a strong identity with those concepts were regarded as basically latent fascists and neurotics and psychotics. So we've had a whole science really developing which states that normative values are actually abnormal. On the other hand, you know, the left is presented as the epitome of the paragon of moral values and virtue, no matter how bizarre the antics of the plebs on the street and their leaders and of the states that have attempted to bring those ideologies into fruition. So there just seems to be a great discrepancy between the information that's available. But in the past, quite a few books and quite a bit of literature was written on the rise of Marxism and its association with psychosis. And first I heard of this was really, I think, probably about 30 years ago in a small booklet by a chap called Major Arch E. Roberts, who was an American conservative, you know, anti-communist type, and he wrote a little book called The Anatomy of a Revolution, and he mentioned there Max Nordau's concept of the metoids, and subsequently to that, I also, of course, eventually read Lothrop Stoddard's Revolt Against Civilization, which developed that theme, and also Nebster Webster's book, The French Revolution, which went on a bit about the character traits of some of the Jacobin leaders, etc. So augmenting that was, in more recent years, my personal observations of the antics of the left and their leaders on the streets. And, you know, I think if one ever observes, either on the news or firsthand, the operations of the left and their full glamour, their full glory, one sees marked traits like histrionics, hysteria, you know, and pretty much being a bunch of retards, basically, you know. Another thing that marks them out is their total lack of humour and their viciousness.
I definitely want to go into the, well, I guess the psychology, the mentality. You've done some excellent work on this of the metoids, you know, as you call them, and we can talk about that term a little bit later. But let me back up a bit first, because I've always been very interested in, you know, the French Revolution and you know, the sister revolution over in America, and of course how liberalism kind of came into the world and whatnot. And you've done a great job in looking at the Jacobins and the origins here. Is that really the inception point where everything begins, in your view?
Well, I think that's the one that's most readily identifiable, at least as far as the Western civilization goes, now our present cycle of crisis and decline. That's where the you know, the doctrine can be most readily seen as coming from. And I think we can trace there also a common origin between liberalism of two sorts: the liberalism of free market capitalism and the left-wing liberalism that's, you know, eventually developed even into communism and Marxism, etc. So I think there's a common origin there of both the extreme left and free trade liberalism of both Whiggery, in the English sense, and Marxism. So they have a common background, and that's why people like conservative philosophers such as Oswald Spengler could say that big money is the guiding force of left-wing movements.
Yeah, it seems like we're very much living in the era of where these two have merged, and we're living in that perfect, you know, world now, where anything that goes against the grain basically is in some cases violently opposed as well. But tell us about some of the characters behind here, of course, from you know, very, very, very interesting how they managed to take the hold of France in the way they did, and how they managed to do it. And I know even that you take a little bit of this conspiratorial route as well, specifically looking at you know, we do have a backdrop here with people like Weishaupt from the Illuminati and whatnot, and the Freemasonic connection as well. And it is there, isn't it? That's a kind of a reality of the situation.
Oh, very much so. I've actually written a manuscript on that subject, which is waiting to be published by Arctos Media Limited at some stage. And I think, as you say, Freemasonry is very much involved in the foundation of a lot of this stuff we now have. And, you know, one tends to overlook Freemasonry now and you know, consider it sort of eclipsed, but it has had a very influential role to play in world revolutions, and especially in the Catholic countries, where there's a you know, an antagonism there dating right back to its foundations. But the philosophy of the French Revolution I trace with terms of convenience to the Rousseau, and reading his autobiography, which is readily available online, is quite a fascinating education, insofar as that he from the start, he boasts of being probably God's gift to humanity and makes no bones about it, and believes that, you know, any spite of on him is basically a terrible sin, you know, and he seems to be just someone who's, one might say, completely full of himself, and any spite upon him is regarded as, you know, a complete catastrophe for the entirety of humanity, basically. So, you know, with him, we've got what I think is a common thread running throughout the whole lot, or most of these left-wing ideologues and leaders, and that's a narcissistic personality disorder, you know, a form of sociopathic personality disorder. And my basic theme is that the left and left-wing ideologies are really rationalizations for these types of sociopathic personality disorders. They're you know, a sort of defense mechanism and for these unbalanced people, and a means of projecting their own violent and abnormal tendencies onto the world as a whole. And Rousseau was very much one of these people. Edmund Burke interviewed him in England and found him, you know, entirely vain. And David Hume tried to support him in England and was just really rubbished in return. And Rousseau was completely paranoid and thought all his friends were basically out to get him and control him. And David Hume remarked, you know, that Rousseau was plainly mad, and after long being maddish, had become completely insane. So, you know, we have basically the Jacobin and encyclopedic philosophy that led up to the French Revolution being formulated by someone who was very, very flawed in his mentality, and regarded his entire life as one of great misfortune, although his childhood was actually rather privileged, and his father was quite doting on him. But as in other people, such as Karl Marx and numerous other left-wing notables, he could only remember his childhood and life in terms of the utmost agony. So he had, you know, he was a hypochondriac, he thought. All sorts of things were wrong with him, and they had, you know, typical features of bipolar personality and the narcissism that blames his own feelings onto others. And, you know, from all this, it's just a short step to projecting all these failings onto society as a whole and blaming society for one's own shortcomings. And he actually said in his autobiography that the way he formulated his philosophy was to look at his own life, the way he perceived it, and projected onto humanity as a whole. So his own personal life was basically a ground plan for his own philosophy towards humanity. and then some of the people involved with the revolution. One of the remarks at the time by historians, which is brought out by Nestor Webster, for instance, is that they seem to have a very sickly look to them. And she suggested that it often indicated some sort of liver failure, which also is associated with mental aberrations. And Jean-Paul Marat has been described as she calls him a malignant dwarf with a sickly yellow skin and a person of perpetual excitement, which would be a type of neurasthenia, which, you know, a type of nervous energy that constantly requires excitation. And there's the more, although I don't mention it in the book, but there's a rather recent finding subsequent to the book on Robespierre, and it refers to him having sarcoidosis, and that results in pockmarked skin and a sickly look and a bipolar personality, OCD, and panic attacks and anxiety attacks, etc. So there seems to be a common thread running through these Jacobin leaders, indicating both physical and mental illness.
Right. Yeah, and I think you're right as well. And it's an interesting point how the sadism that we saw in the French Revolution has largely kind of escaped, critical psychological analysis of these leaders and ideologues, right?
Yeah, well, as it has it, you know, I mean, the very word self-sadism, of course, comes from Desart, who was himself a great hero of the French Revolution. And, you know, when the revolution triumphed, he was in a lunatic asylum at the time, and he was released and became a member of the National Assembly and was looked upon with a great deal of admiration by the revolutionary movement. And in his puerile books, there's a great deal which is the precursor to Marxism. He talks basically about class struggle and detestation of the family, and he talks in terms of the family and abortion, for instance, in terms very familiar today as to what, you know, our so-called progressives talk about. You know, what he was saying several hundred years ago has just been re-spouted today by our so-called progressives, and is claimed to be the paragon of modernism. But it's just really a rehashing from a demented bloody aristocrat from France who was in a mental institution, you know. So, you know, it's quite appropriate that someone such as Desart should be held up by the French Revolution as someone of such impeccable moral fortitude.
Right. Let's talk a little bit more about what is at the root of this, and what do you think is driving this? Obviously, if we are working with some kind of mental, instability, mental disease, etc., that in itself can explain quite a bit. But at the same time, you know, you have a very high intelligence here, a very dedicated type of personality that very much becomes obsessed almost with toppling over. Well, it's really a revolt against civilization in itself.
Yeah,
correct?
That's precisely, and of course that is precisely what Rob Stoddard called his book, and what just after the Bolshevik Revolution, many people were calling Bolshevism a revolt against civilization. You know, Winston Churchill, for instance, referred to it as a conspiracy of envious malevolence, and envy plays a large part in the left. But you know, one would expect that from the downtrodden people who, you know, undeniably have a raw deal out of much that is wrong with the capitalist system. But in fact, as we know, the revolutionary movements are more often led by the bourgeoisie and intelligentsia, etc.
Yeah,
people that would otherwise be successful. So what we really have to look at is why some of these people that have such an advantageous background and good education, you know, really don't make it in society. And that's where we come to the basic character flaws, which mean that they are outside normative values and normal society, and react to it with an impulsion to destroy it and say, oh, we are progressists, we're intellectuals, we're going to destroy society because it's oppressive. But they only feel it personally as oppressive because they feel alienated from normative values. And this is what Max Nordau called the Matoids in his 1895 book called Degeneration. And Max Nordau, he actually became a quite a prominent Zionist with Theodore Herzl. But
oh, really? Oh.
Prior to that, though, he was a Hungarian physician who made a study of degeneration and its impact upon civilization. And he uses the word matoid from the Italian matto, as an insane. And just prior to him, there was Cesar Lombroso, if I remember the name right, who's regarded as the founder of criminology. And he was using terms like borderline dwellers and higher degenerates. So we have, you know, all these people that are highly intelligent, but gravitate towards abnormal ideologies as a rationalization for their destructive tendencies. And there has been a theory in recent times that basically says that intelligent people make really stupid decisions. There's something called the Savannah IQ interaction hypothesis, developed by someone called Satoshi Kanazawa. And he says that, you know, the highly intelligent will naturally gravitate towards novel ideas and what's new or what's perceived to be new at any given time in society, the exotic, etc. But such, you know, radical strange choices aren't necessarily how society as a whole can function. I mean, society as a whole really relies on a conservative balance between change and stability. But what the, you know, quite often the highly intelligent people often seem to need is difference and change and something to exhilarate their life, basically. So from what I gather, the theory of IQ interaction hypothesis really comes down to intelligent people being attracted to really stupid things. I mean, that's, for instance, why you see, you know, intelligent people destroying themselves on drugs and alcohol, and highly successful people doing the same. Yeah. You know, they've got it all from the viewpoint of plebs such as myself, but they just self-destruct because they're highly functioning, and in some respects there's a mental imbalance there. And while that might be destructive in an individual sense, with the left, with the people that gravitate towards the left, well, that's a rationalised ideology for those self-destructive tendencies, which are sort of projected and generalised onto society and an entire civilization. And both Rich Stoddard and Max Nordau, etc., made the point that these people regard civilization and normative values themselves as oppressive. They regard it as, you know, they think they've been personally oppressed by the basic laws and customs of decency and civil society, and they can't stand such oppression, so they need to bring it down. So therefore they gravitate towards the most destructive ideologies. So, you know, that's basically what I think the leadership and of the left boils down to. And, of course, there's numerous other reasons why the rank and file are attracted to the same thing, and trying to prove themselves one way or the other, which is, you know, another topic that branches out from that, which we can discuss.
Definitely. I mean, I think it's very interesting you mentioned this, that there's a, instead of trying to, I guess, adapt to circumstances of, I guess, order or what we could call normality to a certain extent, they, as they see as a prison, there is a desire to, I guess, change the external world and turn that into their sadistic playground as opposed to trying to adapt to the rules, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well put. Yeah. And, you know, you could call something like the 1970 revolution just a mass exercise in insanity. You know, so the lunatic asylums had been, you know, the patients have been released and run amok over the entirety of society and killed whatever they regard as, you know, better than themselves, basically. It was Nathaniel Weil, the American psychologist who and ex-communist, who referred to aristocide, the impulsion to kill not aristocrats per se specifically, but anyone, you know, that's creative or has a, you know, a sort of culture, what we might call a culture-bearing strata. You know, the revolutionaries and intellectuals feel frustrated with their own lack of culture and civility. And you know, the first to die in the revolution is those who have culture and something valuable to contribute to society. And we see in things like the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution, not only, you know, the wealthy being killed en masse, but scientists and artists and people of culture, you know, and the libraries burnt. And even during the French Revolution, there was a suggestion that the rare animals kept by the Museum of Natural History be killed off. Because there's a great resentment against any form of learning, and Robespierre, as a famous chemist, I can't recall the name at the moment, but Lothrop Stoddard refers to it in his book. He's about to be sent to the guillotine, and Robespierre remarked that the revolution has no need for sages. So, you know, it's basically the lopping off the head of a country, you know, culturally and intellectually. And I suppose when you say intellectually, the intellectuals that are drawn to these left-wing movements, I don't really think tend to be engineers and physicists, but people that have done well in, you know, totally useless subjects, philosophy and bloody the arts, and, you know, the liberal arts or whatever, you know, they're not people that have contributed anything, you know, practical to civilization other than a bunch of mucky ideas, basically, you know.
Well, you call it, you know, both Jacobinism, but also Bolshevism, as you mentioned here, the revolt of the under man. Tell us more about that.
Yeah. Well, that's basically another term from that Stoddard uses, and it's this. He gives this this image of a great swirl of masses of people being led by the matoids and then agitated against the state. And of course, you know, there are many instances in history where there have been injustices to resolve and systems that are so rotten they should be destroyed, but you know, the left, the extreme left, has been able to agitate the lowest forms of the population and overthrow a social order. For instance, in France, the revolt really began in Versailles, and, you know, which you know, some of the contemporary observers commented upon at the time was a port city that attracted the worst possible people from the Mediterranean, basically the dregs of society, and the, you know, drunks and whores and other such people one would expect to become part of the left. And you know, it didn't take much to agitate them. There's also written accounts of these people being fed copious amounts of narcotics drink and even given money to march through the streets. I mean, the Duke of Orleans was providing the purse strings for the French Revolution, and so there's money floating about in plentitude for the revolutionaries. And so, you know, you had that anyone that could be persuaded to murder and loot and destroy, you know, being thrown some alcohol or a few coins, and being led off to march against the army and the state, etc.
Right.
And, you know, some of the most heroic efforts opposing the French Revolution came from peasants and workers and tradesmen. You know, they fought with their lives to defend the monarchy. You know, there's it's not by any means certain that the monarchy was universally despised in France. And, you know, when the Bastille was stormed, you know, that's become a sort of archetypical image of the tyranny of France. Well, you know, there's only a couple of people actually in it. You know, like Tsarist Russia too, we've had a great deal of propaganda against these monarchist regimes, but that propaganda I don't think is by any means accurate. You know, I think, you know, while people might have wanted change, they certainly didn't want it to the extent of destroying the monarchy or the Tsar or whatever. And those demands basically came from these matoids and intelligentsia who had a personal grudge against the monarchy. You know, it's a society they couldn't fit into themselves, so they had to destroy it. But it's not the same as the people as a whole wanting such destruction.
Exactly. And we're going to get a little bit later here to our so-called modern Western liberal democracies a bit later and kind of look at how this applies today and whatnot. But just to continue a little bit here on the history of this, what do you think is the outcome, at least of some of these people that were behind the revolutions or whatnot? Because there is murmurs here, of course, that it was about, you know, if civilization is the enemy, then we need to go back to nature, basically, right? But what's interesting here, and you point this out as well, is that it's kind of a faux version of nature, is a one doctored in the intellectual mind of what it must be like, kind of the idea of the noble savage, really, right?
Exactly. And, you know, I'm sort of reminded once again of this sort of new theory of the savannah IQ interaction hypothesis of intelligent people being attracted to really stupid ideas. And of course, as we know, all these ideas about nature mostly came from people sitting in their drawing rooms writing about what they thought it would be. And, you know, people like Rousseau and Desades, they looked upon nature as really the freeing of man from all bonds of responsibility and civility, where, you know, the individual become completely free to a completely permissive society to do whatever they like. And that's what they imagined the noble savage to be. Instead, as we know, the noble savage was completely degraded being living in his own crap, basically. And you know, there's nothing elevating whatsoever at all about it. But given the mental aberrations of people like Rousseau and Marat and all these other people, you know, maybe that is what they did regard as utopia, the prospect of everyone living in their own crap, you know. That is basically the type of people they were. They themselves and their personal lives were extremely, you know, filthy, for instance, and non-hygienic. People commented about that as to Marx, but also, you know, Jean-Paul Marat, he lived in very comfortable conditions, but you know, in his personal life, he is a filthy little salt, you know.
right.
So you know, I think, you know, once again, you know, the civilization is seen as some great restraint, and the myth of the noble savage is seen as the ultimate in a free society, and with all the, you know, supposed sophistication of Marxist ideology and the utopia of the future communist state, even he really was looking to some sort of pre-civilized world, you know, sort of an atavism, really, going back to origins so primitive that one wonders whether they would really want us to go right back to the state of being an amoeba.
Well, do you think that these people actually would be happy and content in nature?
Because of their pathetic nature, they'd be the first to die off.
Right.
The idea of the ideal and the real, or the ideal self and the real self, being in conflict and being such a vast distance between the two, is completely utopian. But utopian more likely dystopian, actually. What these people regard as a utopia, normal people would regard as an utter nightmare of filth and degradation. Some sick people actually like the idea of filth and degradation. So once again, it's a rationalisation, a philosophy of the atavistic and the primitive made to look somehow progressive and desirable. So, and today we of course see that the same cult of the savage. It's even more entrenched in academia and in our popular cultures today than what it was in the Rousseau's time. Every time we look upon the masses of Africa, etc., we are supposed to see great civilizations there and the nobility of the humble Negro dwelling in plenty until he became enslaved by the evil white man, it's the same mentality, but it just doesn't exist. And one famous example of it was Margaret Mead's book, The Coming of Age in Samoa, which became a landmark in cultural and social anthropology. Not so long ago, an Australian anthropologist and honorary Samoan chief named Derek Freeman completely exposed Margaret Mead's data as a complete fraud and said that when she interviewed Samoan pubescent girls on their life, they were just basically taking the proverbial out of her and thought she was a great joke, really, and she came away with a completely wrong impression of Samoan society, saying how they're all peaceful and their permissiveness allowed for a type of freedom that the West could only envy. And she's since been exposed as a total and inept fraud, basically.
Right. Yeah.
But this is the idea that's still prevalent in academia and in the left.
Yeah, I mean, if we just for a moment look at the French Revolution again here, how do we attribute their success? I mean, I know you mentioned alcohol, other, drugs to exacerbate the situation, with the plebes and whatnot, but was it the timing that made them successful? Because it's pretty amazing that the military in France didn't manage to kind of halt the progress here.
Well, I think we're looking at, I'm basically a Spenglerian, and I see things in history in terms of cycles. And I think we can sort of start the West's cycle of decay from around that era.
Right.
So, nothing's going to work unless it's in the right cycle. And I think it was in the right cycle. It was a time of decay, of the start of decay. Those types of people for that situation naturally arise and are able to take advantage of it. I heard a little bit by a recent guest of yours, Anthony Midgetills, is it? The military reformer?
Let's see. Yeah, who was it? Say the name again.
Anthony Midgetills?
The Dutch. Oh. That's right. Exactly. Yes.
And he made the point that looking through history, he finds that in every crisis of history, there's been an ongoing battle between the people and usury.
Yes.
And I think very much that we don't allow enough for the impact of faulty finances and banking, which is something we might be able to talk about later, in civilization and the course of history. And, one of the faults of French society at the time was the tremendous debt floating around in society, which undermine the basic social structure.
Right, yeah.
And ironically, you know, the wealthy people that own this debt, people like the Duke of Orleans, were also happen to be the people that supported the revolution. Because we should also keep in mind that although the revolution brought in many factors that we now recognise as communistic, it was also a time when the free market idea came in as a revolutionary force, and the French Revolution actually destroyed an old regime that was still based upon the guild concept, which had a certain social ethos and a certain restraint against unbridled capitalism,
right.
And established free trade as the ideal. So, so far from the French Revolution ushering a great new or rather traditional order of social ethos, has actually introduced unbridled capitalism to the West.
Interesting. Yeah, that's very paradoxical indeed. And also, of course, as you mentioned, ironically, the progressive ideal then, which you know, implies by the wording that is going forward and whatnot, is really an ideal of degeneracy and atavism, right? It's a return to, you know, something ancient and something old, and we kind of see that, as you say, kind of come full circle. And if you look at you know, the world today and the movements that we have in place today in our liberal democracies, it's really we're at the cusp of that cycle, or when that begun, really. I mean, we have things like, you detail this in the book as well, obviously the Frankfurt School. We do have the, you know, political correctness there as a kind of an inhibitor and whatnot. But what are they pushing for today? If you look at the situation of how they're controlling the debate and everything, what is their goal here, do you think, at the end of things?
Well, basically, what the Illuminati was talking about several hundred years ago, a world state. But whereas we tend to think in terms of that as a communistic thing, it is in fact out of the capitalistic, you know, ideal. And as I've written of in other books, such as Revolution from Above, the left has served as a battering ram for big money. And when you look at it, you know, they both stem. Capitalism, big capitalism, and the left stem from a common source. And so far as they're both materialistic, they're both motivated by economic reductionism. They see man as merely matter in motion. Economics as the sole guiding principle of humanity and of history. They both want a world state. They both want man en masse as an economic being. They have so many things in common. That there's a convergence of ideas, basically, and a convergence of aims, and they almost act really in a dialectical process of controlled opposition and interaction until we start getting society shifted gradually further and further over towards the left. I mean, big capitalists like Rockefeller, etc., are often regarded as the epitome of conservatism and the right, but that's complete nonsense. I mean, these people want a world state so they can have a unhindered flow of labour, capital, and technology. In order that what they would see as a more efficient world economy. You know, to them, things like nations, separate ethnicities and cultures and languages, that's all the big burden to maximum profits.
Yeah.
So, beneath all these, the economic theories and the aberrations of the left, you have, I think, a higher authority pulling the strings, you know, and using these various movements for their own purposes. And one could say that these also are matoids. I mean, you know, anyone that really wants such total power is probably, you know, someone who's unbalanced, probably has a messiah complex, like George Soros has often been stated to be someone with a messiah complex. They think they can change the world for the better, but it's the world in their own personal image, you know.
Yeah, exactly. They do a lot of damage in their Well, as we know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, right?
I
definitely want to ask a little bit more about, you know, multiculturalism and some of the things that we see, the changes we see in the West, you know, a little bit later here. But let's just talk about politicized psychiatry before we go there, because I think that's an important thing about how this has been used against dissidents in the liberal West. And you do talk a couple of examples from Ezra Pound, but all the way up to Barry Goldwater, basically. Tell us more about this.
Yeah, well, Barry Goldwater, when he was running for the presidency, a number of psychiatrists came out and issued a joint declaration saying that he has classic symptoms of, psychosis, basically. I guess, once again, going back to the authoritarian personality S-scale, which says that normative values aren't actually normative values at all, but they're actually latent fascism just ready to unleash upon the world all sorts of genocide, etc. So, of course, Enoch Powell, I mean, he was, lambasted by Tony Benn, the Labour Party leader at the time, as his ideas leading to another Auschwitz. There's all this mad exaggeration. But you've also had, well, at the moment, as I mentioned to you before the interview, I'm writing a biography on Francis Parker Yockey.
That's right.
And, as we know, he committed suicide rather than be subjected to a psychiatric examination. But at that time, having studied the background a bit, I think he had very good reasons to be fearful of what was going to happen to him. Like around about 1966, there was a chap called Frederick Selig, who was at one time apparently quite a successful and well-known journalist. And he started looking into child abuse and a homosexual communist network involved with childcare in the Department of Social Welfare in the United States. And for doing so, and for he had basically had his kids taken off him, and he was confined to Spring Hill's psychiatric prison hospital in Missouri for several years. And he wrote a book after his release called Destroy the Accuser, which you can find online. And that is an absolutely harrowing account of what constitutes really mental torture. They are out really to mentally and physically break anyone they could get hold of. And this also relates to, I think it's called KM Ultra or some CIA program that was started in the around about the 1950s, that
MK Ultra and some of these.
It was based in a big hospital in Canada and run by a Scots psychiatrist for the CIA, and they were experimenting on people there and absolutely destroying their mind and turning them into virtual zombies. During the 1960s and 1970s, it was common practice just to send off anyone of a right wing temperament or activity who got into trouble with the law to have a psychiatric examination. And that even happened to General Edwin Walker, one of the top military men in America who after his leaving the army, he was a great supporter of maintaining segregation. And he is a leader in the resistance against desegregation in the South, and they whipped him off to a psychiatric hospital, but it was only through strenuous efforts and popular support that they were able to get Walker out, and a jury was able to free him. And but to people like Selig, who didn't have such support, they sometimes remained in hospital for several years, and their minds were just broken people.
Like forcefully medicated, lobotomized, maybe?
Oh, exactly, yeah. And after Selig was released, he wrote a book, but before he had a chance to write a second book, he died of a heart enlargement. And that's often accounted for by the treatment he received in the psychiatric institutions. But I was just reading an account recently of a chap who ran an anti-communist organisation called Breakthrough in America. It was a local organisation, and he was arrested for causing a bit of a disturbance outside a Catholic church, because he is a Catholic himself, and was protesting against some sort of left-wing contrivance in the church. And he was arrested, and even he was ordered to go through a psychiatric examination, and that was only on a misdemeanor charge of a $100 fine. But the judge made a comment, "I'd like to know how your mind works." So all that sort of thing was going on quite readily in America in the 1960s and 70s, you know. And one hears about, you know, something similar in the Soviet Union, but it seemed to be quite pervasive in the United States.
Well, indeed, exactly. Now, tell us, we're going to take a break in a few minutes here, but before we do that, let's talk about Freudianism, and I guess the tie-in with Marxism as well, but specifically Freudianism has been used against us, and the focus on sexuality, right? That everything has a kind of a sexual connotation. It's all about suppression of sexuality that leads to all these issues and problems. How has that been used against us in the West?
Well, Freud was consciously out to undermine the West, and he was quite popular in giving talks to the Bernard Brith Lodge in Vienna and various other institutions, you know, that felt alienated from the West, and welcomed anyone that would actually undermine the Western ethos. And what we've had is numerous examples of Freudianism being combined with the left. I mean, you know, you can see this most readily in the New Left, for instance, where they quote Marx, Marcuse, and Freud, and you know, in one breath, basically. And there was a synthesis, pretty much. Another one was Wilhelm Reich, you know, who developed the concept of orgone energy, and tried to politicize the concept of the orgasm or something or other. But the Communist Party in Germany, even that rejected those notions as being, you know, too wild out and extreme. Whereas these types that advocated this Freudian Marxian synthesis, you know, they are welcomed with open arms in the United States, and they gained you know, brilliant reputations in U.S. academia, and developed entire theories around a sort of sexual revolution that, you know, was helped along by Kinsey, although I don't think he had any particular political motive, but certainly his studies were used, and still are, by the Kinsey Institute and various other people who want to basically drag the Western society down, and, you know, relates back, I guess, again to activism and the cult of the primitive.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's a huge story here, and we're going to get deeper into that here a little bit later. But let's talk about some of your titles here as well. Obviously, the main book we've been talking about, you know, here so far is called The Psychotic Left. And, of course, you have a lot of other titles out there as well, Carrie. The Artist of the Right, you have Stalin, The Enduring Legacy, The Banking Swindle. And I believe your latest one, is it Babel Inc., Multiculturalism, Globalization, and the New World Order as well?
Yes, that's correct. That one tells basically what we were talking about previously as to the motives of the big business and wanting to form a world state. And, you know, one way to do that is to promote multiculturalism in order to break down the different nations and ethnicities and cultures, etc. And sort of, once again, it's a paradox, or one might call it dialectics, insofar as, you know, these people talk about differences on one hand and celebrating differences, but on the other hand, the outcome really is to make everyone in the same image. And I guess it could be related to deconstructing. One uses multiculturalism in order to deconstruct and then rebuild, and what one gets is not diversity, but, you know, universal sameness, basically, everyone working for the, you know, the same profit motive and the same, you know, well-being of a very small elite up the top. You know, we have United States State Department in particular being avid promoters of things like hip-hop and, you know, all this sort of pseudo-ghetto subculture in Europe. And especially France. France is a prime target for the United States and its multicultural agenda, probably because France is one of the few countries which has often, you know, maintained a fairly independent course from U.S. foreign policy. And you know, recently their ambassador, he's no longer ambassador, but up until a few years ago, it was Charles Rivkin. WikiLeaks exposed a memorandum that he circulated, which is an entire program of pushing multiculturalism onto France as a means of destroying what he refers to as French xenophobia,
yeah,
and undermining, you know, the rise of groups like the National Front, etc. So there's a specifically stated agenda to destroy what the Americans call, you know, white or European xenophobia by the use of multiculturalism. And in this instance, it's often the use of, you know, the Muslim communities.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, they're quite open about this. I mean, even Wesley, yeah, Clark, the NATO guy, he talked about this as well, you know, talking openly about, you know, how there no longer could be any, you know, ethnically pure European nations. You know,
That's right. I think he said in connection with when they were bombing the hell out of Serbia, didn't he?
Yep, yeah, that's right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. That was a beginning of that process, I think, for real. But let's definitely pick that up after the break. I want to talk more about the you know, multiculturalism in Europe, and of course a little bit later get into more of the economy as well. You've written a lot about the bankers, the central banking system and all that stuff. But let's give out some website here, Kerry, because obviously the we can give the publisher's website, blackhousepublishing.com. You can find a number of Kerry Bolton's titles right there, but there is a couple of other ones as well that I know you wanted to mention, Kerry. So let's give those out as well, where people can go to read more about your material.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's, another one is Count Currents Publishing, which is published by book Artists of the Right. And they're also due to publish a book on various essays by Yockey, a lot of which haven't been published previously. And there's Artos Media Limited, which published my book Revolution from Above, and they're due to publish a manuscript on mostly on Freemasonry, and another one probably early next year on a biography on Yockey. So that's two others, Artos Media Limited and Countercurrents Publishing. So they're my three publishers at the moment.
All right, great. We're going to have the links up there, of course. Check out Greg Johnson's great site there, Countercurrents, and also Arctos Media. We're going to have those up there. All right, well, stay with us, Kerry. We'll take a short break, and then we'll be right back, and we'll kick up much more to come.